For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder. The United Nations General Assembly voted overwhelmingly on Thursday to grant Palestine non-member observer state status at the United Nations. The vote of 138 countries in favor, 9 opposed, was taken on the 65th anniversary of the UN vote to divide the former British mandate of Palestine into two states, Israel and Palestine. In retaliation, Israel announced the construction of 3,000 new settlements in the Palestinian territories it occupied in 1967. That was yesterday, Friday. The UN bid is part of a larger movement for Palestinian national rights that may have more symbolism than substance. We're joined on the line today by Muin Rabbani. Mr. Rabbani is co-editor of Jadalia e-zine, or online magazine. He is also contributing editor of Middle East Report and has published and commented widely on Palestinian affairs and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He was a senior analyst of the Middle East with the International Crisis Group. Previously, he worked as Palestine director of the Palestinian American Research Center. Muin Rabbani, welcome to our program.
Good to be here. Thank you.
I wonder if we could start with this General Assembly vote. What does this vote in favor of non-member observer state status mean? It's not recognition. What does it mean in moral, political, and practical terms?
Well, I think that's very much a question that will need to be answered in the coming weeks and months based on what the Palestinians do next and also based on how the international community responds to continued Israeli war crimes in the occupied territories. Most recently, the announcement that they will build 3,000 new housing units in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, which, according to the Rome Statute that established the International Criminal Court, is a war crime. And in fact, since 1949, it's been a war crime when it was defined as a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention. But to get back to your question, faced with increasing popular frustration with the Oslo process, the process of interminable negotiations that are essentially about nothing between Israel and the Palestinians under U.S. sponsorship that began in 1993, and confronted with the resultant collapse of its domestic popularity and legitimacy, the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank last year decided that it needed to take some kind of measure, not only to restore its domestic political credibility, but also to kickstart the so-called peace process. And what it did at the time is it went to the United Nations with the intention of seeking formal UN recognition of Palestinian statehood. That failed because statehood requires the endorsement of the Security Council, and as long as the United States is on that council, it's not going to endorse the principle of Palestinian statehood. And so what they've done this past week has gone back to the UN, but this time to the General Assembly, to obtain a status that is essentially the same as that currently enjoyed by the Vatican, which is that of a non-member observer state. On the face of it, it doesn't change that much, except it does give the Palestinians the right now to accede to various international treaties, including the Rome Statute, and therefore eventually to call for investigations by the ICC into war crimes committed in occupied Palestinian territory. And it could additionally strengthen the position of the Palestinians in bringing further cases to the International Court of Justice.
It's interesting to note that in response to the resolution passed on Thursday, a bipartisan group of United States senators announced they would introduce legislation that would cut off U.S. aid designated for the Palestinian Authority if it appealed to the internet, if the Palestinians appealed to the International Criminal Court for Israeli war crimes. And in fact, they did this. I guess the U.S. cut off U.S. funding to UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. Again, this was Congress, after it, that organization, accepted Palestine as a member. Do you think that these, are these kind of idle threats? Do they have much effect on what I think you're calling the internationalization of, I guess, of, that's of the resolution of this conflict?
Yes, and to get back to your first question first, I mean, this, I think from a Palestinian perspective, this initiative will only be meaningful to the extent that it launches the Palestinians on a trajectory away from continued negotiations with Israel in the context or in the framework of the Oslo agreements and towards an entirely different trajectory, which is reestablishing UN resolutions, international law, and international legitimacy as the framework to deal with and to resolve the question of Palestine. And that's easier said than done, and it has a number of preconditions, including national reconciliation between the rival Palestinian parties, Fatah and Hamas, the formulation of a new national strategic consensus, and the revival of the PLO and all the rest of it. But hardly impossible things, but they do require a lot of work. But nevertheless, I think the signs now for that are more positive than they have been in recent years. Regarding the question you just posed, I mean, personally, I do very much hope that the Palestinians, sooner rather than later, again taking their case to the ICC and once again to the ICJ, and if that should result in a cutoff of American aid, from my point of view, that would be icing on the cake, because American financial support to the Palestinians in recent years has done very little, next to nothing, for Palestinian development and so on. But what it has done is basically placed all kinds of political conditions on the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank, conditions that are inimical to even the minimal national interests of the Palestinians. And therefore, one hopes that with the severance of this aid, there will be at the very least, a diminution of American leverage and influence on Palestinian decision-making, and Palestinian leaders can begin then acting more in the interests of the Palestinian people rather, you know, than a bunch of American congressmen who, on the whole, are more pro-Israeli than Israel itself.
I'd like to get to your comment earlier. You mentioned that you, and I know others also, see this vote as at least partly an effort by Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas to reclaim his pretty weakened role as the representative of all Palestinians. And I wanted to ask what you think about his standing among Palestinians and whether it depends on which Palestinians we're talking about. I know that the Palestinian Authority and Abbas have both been criticized as effectively running the occupation for Israel by their critics.
Running the occupation for Israel is one thing they do, but it's not the only thing they do. I mean, the Palestinian Authority, whatever one may think of it, has also become pretty much the largest employer in the West Bank. It provides all kinds of social services, including health and education and so on, to the Palestinian population. And at the same time, it also engages in very systematic security coordination with the Israeli occupation and so on. So, I mean, you can characterize it in all kinds of ways, but that's not necessarily the only valid characterization of what it actually does on a daily basis. Another point is, you know, people often present this as somehow, you know, Hamas in the Gaza Strip and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. That's not actually accurate. There are today two Palestinian authorities because the government in Gaza is as legitimate or as illegitimate, take your choice, as the government in the West Bank. And so we're really talking here about two rival Palestinian authorities, bizarrely both under Israeli occupation, where one is dominated by Hamas in the Gaza Strip and the other one by Abbas and Fatah in the West Bank. Now, in terms of Abbas's political standing, it is very low. And the problem for him, I think, is that it was always clear that he was going to derive very little credit for going to the United Nations, basically because, at least in the short term, it wasn't going to change anything on the ground. It would amount to little more than a symbolic victory, particularly when compared to the claims Hamas has recently been making on the basis of the recent Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip. But at the same time, he stood to lose quite a bit if he yet again backed off and didn't go to the United Nations. Now, in terms of restoring his public standing, simply winning a vote in the UN General Assembly isn't going to do all that much for him. What is really required, I think, is for him to take the lead or at least participate in a serious effort to rebuild the national movement, to take the lead or participate in the formulation of a new and entirely different Palestinian national strategy. And there's a lot of people who frankly think he's incapable of that, and that these fundamental tasks can only be undertaken once he is no longer on the scene. So he's really got his work cut out for him.
I'm speaking with Muin Rabbani, co-editor of Jadaliya e-Zine, about the UN General Assembly vote last Thursday, granting Palestine non-member observer state status at the United Nations. Muin Rabbani, you mentioned a moment ago about the need for the articulation of a unified national strategy on the part of the Palestinians. What would be the goal of that strategy? There have been numerous criticisms, for example, of the focus on a two-state solution, for example. I know that's one. What in your view, would be a strategy that's viable for the Palestinians now?
Well, I can give you my personal view, but I find that rather irrelevant. I think what really matters is, love it or hate it, the Palestinian political system remains one that is dominated by two major political forces these days, Fatah and Hamas. And they're the ones who are going to have to formulate a national strategy that is not only acceptable to the two of them, but one that can also be endorsed by at least a majority of the smaller factions, such as the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Islamic Jihad, and so on. My own view is that this entire debate about, one state versus two state is, to put it politely, premature. I mean, I've previously compared it to someone, convicted to death and agonizing the night before his execution about which pension plan to join. I mean, I think, the Palestinians have a very long way to go before the choice between one or two states becomes a serious question that they're capable of answering, in a sense that their response to that question will have a real impact within the actually existing world. My own view is that under the current circumstances, Palestinians have to, at least in the short term, develop a strategy and tactics that will essentially do two things. First and foremost, a strategy that seeks to arrest and reverse Israeli impunity in its dealings with the Palestinian people. And here, I think, a resort to the ICC and the ICJ and activating legal instruments already at their disposal, like the 2004 ICJ advisory opinion on the West Bank wall, could serve a very useful purpose, as could, for example, the Goldstone report that resulted from Israel's 2008-2009 assault on the Gaza Strip. So on the one hand, arresting and reversing Israeli impunity, and second of all, devising a strategy to more actively and effectively confront the Israeli occupation. Now, my sense, at least my personal sense, is that whether one endorses a one-state or two-state framework, dealing with and reversing and terminating the Israeli occupation and its settlement policies is an essential precondition and prerequisite for either of those two outcomes. And I think as long as Palestinians don't yet have the means to deal with that effectively, as I was saying at the beginning of my answer, I find that whole debate quite hypothetical and theoretical.
Well, to be fair to the many iterations of it, I know that Israeli commentators also talk about a one-state solution, but of course they're talking about, by default, by this continued process of occupation and annexation of Palestinian lands, you end up effectively with this, with the West Bank and well, I think they're referring more to the West Bank, effectively part of the Israeli state, ruled by the Israeli state without actually taking responsibility for its population. I don't know what you think about that, but I want to get go ahead.
I guess interrupts you, and in response to that,
sure,
I mean,
do.
You know, it seems to me that there's more logic for this debate to be taking place among Israeli rather than Palestinian decision makers, because Israel is, as you pointed out, in full control of all of historic Palestine, and Israel is actually in a position where it can make a choice about this question and implement that choice, if you will, tomorrow morning. That is not today the case with the Palestinians, which I'm saying to put some context on my previous answer. Now, arguably, you know, there already is a one-state as well as a two-state reality in historic Palestine. On the one hand, you know, it's all under Israeli, all under Israeli control or occupation or whatever you want to call it. So you do have a one-state reality that's not all that different from South Africa, in the sense that, you know, you have significant areas of territory with people, you know, from the so-called minority without citizenship. Yet at the same time, you also have separate entities, in the sense that the Palestinian Authority, more so in Gaza than in the West Bank, while still, you know, having the legal status of occupied territory, nevertheless has some trappings that go well beyond autonomy.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if in that light also, I'm thinking about the role of civil society, when you do have in under conditions of occupation, and also reflecting the reality of Palestinians who are Israeli citizens who live inside Israel, there is more of an emphasis on equality, seeking equality, civil, legal, political equality for Palestinians, equal human rights, equal recognition as members, for example, as citizens of Israel. I'm thinking also of manifestations like Stop the Wall campaign, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, human rights, the human rights movement. I wonder if you could say something about what these movements bring to the table.
Well, I don't want to belittle the role of what you call civil society. I mean, they have a role to play, and sometimes they have an important role to play. But the fact of the matter is that you know, Palestinians are living in a context of national liberation. And that includes, by the way, all Palestinians, not just those in the occupied territories, but also those who live within Israel and in the diaspora. And that's the case whether one endorses a one or two or 17 state framework. And I think the priority for the Palestinians should be to rebuild and revive and rejuvenate their national movement with a coherent leadership pursuing an effective strategy and meaningful tactics. Now, you know, many civil society activists always like to point to South Africa as an example. I agree, but the reason I agree is because if you look at the South African example, it was actually the presence and power and coherence of the African National Congress that allowed civil society and international solidarity movements and so on to play as effective a role as they did. In other words, I think you need a coherent national liberation movement in order to empower and strengthen these other actors in a way that, in my view, they really can't under the present circumstances. I'm not saying, you know, they don't have a role to play, nor am I saying they're not doing useful things that are sometimes effective and filling a gap where there has been a vacuum because of the effective demise of the national movement. But I think logically, you know, if what you need is an effective and coherent national liberation movement, including the participation of the main political movements, first and foremost, and above all else, and in my view, everything else is essentially secondary.
Do you see possible unification between the Fatah party, which dominates the Palestinian Authority in the West and well on the West Bank, and Hamas, the elected government of Gaza?
Yes, I do. I don't think it will be easy. Most people who look at the, or many people at least who look at this, tend to see this as some kind of ideological war between a Islamist, more radical Hamas, and a secular and more moderate Fatah in the West Bank. My own view is that there's actually very little to separate them in terms of their national programs in 2012. I think the differences between them are primarily over issues of power and issues of dividing, you know, what remains of the Palestinian Authority. So, you know, some might say that makes it more complicated, but I don't see that there's much standing in the way of a national strategic consensus between these two movements. And particularly in light of Hamas feeling strengthened and emboldened in the aftermath of the most recent Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip, and now the West Bank leadership feeling the same after this UN vote, I would hope that the prospects for ending the schism are better than they have been in a long time.
What do you think of, well, the official U.S. and Israeli reaction to this vote at the General Assembly, that it somehow undermines the possibility of a negotiated settlement between the Palestinians and the Israelis? I kind of want to take it back to your earlier point about internationalization of this question of the Palestinian national autonomy. And if you can tell me, if not negotiations with Israel, what are you actually talking about? You're talking about getting outside the bilateral framework between those two.
Look, I mean, you know, I think you've just accurately presented the U.S.-Israeli position. And my response to that would be to say that Canada, the Czech Republic, and several Pacific Islands who probably neither you nor I have ever heard of, nor any of your listeners, agree, and the rest of the planet,
right,
the entire rest of the planet, disagrees. So you can, you know, base here, you can assess that position on that basis.
But no one is calling Israel to task. And how does one get these two to the negotiating table?
And the reason no one is calling Israel to task, or that very few are calling Israel to task, is because Israel is understood as having the full, unconditional, and uncritical support of the most powerful state in the world, namely the United States. And if you look at the lengths the U.S. went to prevent this latest vote in the U.N., and then when they couldn't stop it, to basically seek to bully the rest of the globe into, you know, voting pro-Likud, I think that helps explain it. But to get back to your question, I don't think the issue here is whether one is for or against negotiations. If this conflict is going to be resolved, at the end of the day, as in virtually every other conflict in history, there is going to have to be a negotiated resolution. To the best of my knowledge, that's how every other colonial conflict has ended. The issue here is, what do you negotiate about, and in what framework do you negotiate? Now, the Oslo framework, which began in 93 and which still goes on today, or at least formally still exists today, has essentially been one of interminable, indefinite, meaningless negotiations about nothing that go on forever. That's why I've opposed them, this process, from the very outset. There is no framework for resolving this this conflict. So what is required, in my view, is an entirely different framework, one where these negotiations do not take place under kind of the sole sponsorship and supervision of the United States, which has declared its eternal love for one of the parties to the conflict, and whose own parliament, the U.S. Congress, often takes more radical positions on this issue than does the Israeli Knesset. You know, the U.S. is basically not a competent broker, let alone an honest one. I think there needs to be a larger role for the international community, as represented by the will of the international community, which is these various UN resolutions and so on that the U.S. has so strenuously opposed. That needs to be the framework. And then once that framework is established, then negotiations could become a meaningful way to end this conflict. But under the current circumstances, no. The so-called peace process basically serves as a fig leaf for the consolidation of Israeli occupation.
Muin Rabbani, I think we have to end it right here. I want to thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure to be with you.
It was a real pleasure to have you join us. I've been speaking with Muin Rabbani, co-editor of Jadalia, an online magazine. He joined us from Amman, Jordan. For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder.